Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Dr. Lacey Hunt. He's an internationally recognized economist, the executive VP and chief economist of Hoisington Investment Management Company. It's a firm that manages over $3.8 billion for pension funds, endowments, insurance companies, and others. He also served in the past as senior economist for the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, where he was a member of the Federal Reserve System Committee on Financial Analysis. Welcome, Dr. Hunt.
Nice to be with you, Richard.
Great. I thought we'd have a discussion on a variety of topics relating to the economy and the financial markets. You recently mentioned that you thought this was the worst economic expansion recovery in U.S. history since 1790. Wow. Can you elaborate?
Well, if you calculate the average growth rate in the expansion since 1790, this is the slowest. It's a long-running expansion, but it's the slowest. And the last 10 years, the household sector has fared very poorly. The rate of growth in real disposable household income per capita is only 0.9% per year. And in the last 12 months, we're only up 0.6% per year. So it's a long-running expansion, but it's been a poor expansion. Certainly, it's some of the earlier data, there are certain problems with it, but this is clearly the slowest expansion since the end of World War II, and our households are the main problem. They've not kept up.
And do you point finger for this cause as primarily on the Federal Reserve, or do you see structural changes happening to the economy?
I think that the main element that has depressed the growth has been that the U.S. economy is so heavily leveraged. We have too much public and private debt. And the debt, unfortunately, does not generate an income stream for the aggregate economy. And as a result of the prolonged higher indebtedness, which is on the verge of going much higher because of the problems in the governmental sector, the economy is now experiencing very poor demographics. We have a baby bust, a household formation bust. The birth rate is the lowest since 1937. And this is exacerbating the problems because we have too much of the wrong type of debt. And because we have too much of the wrong type of debt, the velocity of money is falling. And in fact, the velocity this year will be the lowest since 1949, only 1.43. And the debt creates a situation where monetary policy capabilities are asymmetric. A lot of action to sort of stimulate the economy has a very muted impact on economic activity, whereas a little bit of tightening goes a long way in depressing economic activity. So, but the root cause of this underperformance is the extreme indebtedness.
And what about the Federal Reserve? How has it undermined the economy's ability to grow? You've recently observed it.
Well, the Federal Reserve, the most serious mistakes were really made in the 1990s up until 2006, which allowed the private sector to become so extremely over indebted with the wrong type of debt. And I think that the quantitative easing has, in essence, created more problems for the economy than it has solved. By saying that they wanted higher stock prices, it's caused the corporate executives to switch funds from real capital investments into financial investments, paying higher dividends, buying shares, their own company back, buying shares of others. And while this type of action does produce a higher stock market, it doesn't generate a higher standard of living. And so Federal Reserve policy, I think, has not served the economy well overall, although it certainly has served components of the economy extremely well.
And due to that, do you think that there's been too much financial investment versus real economy investment in terms of diverting the economic financial resources away from the real economy?
I think that's the principal problem. Business debt last year reached a record relative to GDP. And as I said, it's created a higher stock market, but it has not generated a higher standard of living. That's the basic problem. And I think when the Federal Reserve undertook quantitative easing, it was sort of a signal to the corporate executives that we prefer financial investments and we'll do what we can to protect financial investments. But that meant that financial asset investment was preferred over real side investment. And so that it's intermingling with the growth depressing effects of too much debt. And unfortunately, the debt levels are getting ready to move substantially higher in the in the U.S. governmental sector. Government debt is already approaching 106% of GDP, with the exception of a brief period during World War II. It's a record. And by 2030, federal debt will be approximately 125% GDP. We've known about these problems, these demographic problems, for a long time that would inflate the entitlements. But there is also an increasing likelihood that the new federal programs, tax reductions, expenditure increases, will further accelerate the growth in federal debt. And I think that there is very clear evidence that increases in federal debt at these very high levels relative to GDP over any measurable length of time, it reduces economic activity. There's a negative multiplier, not a positive multiplier. It's exactly what David Ricardo hypothesized in 1821, and I think that's confirmed. I myself have looked at the relationship between per capita changes in real GDP and per capita percent changes in government debt per capita, and the relationship is negative, not positive. And so that's basically the problem. We're trying to solve an indebtedness problem by taking on more debt. You can get intermittent spurts of economic activity and inflation, but ultimately the debt is a millstone around the economy's neck.
So would you say that we have migrated to a sort of financial economy?
Yeah, and let me give you a couple of examples. There's so much liquidity in the financial markets, particularly the stock market, that a lot of the economic news is interpreted very constructively, even when it's not constructive. I mean, virtually the whole world believes that the United States is experiencing large job gains. That really isn't even questioned. But the rate of growth in payroll employment on a 12-month basis peaked at 2.4% in early 2015. In the last 12 months, we're down to 1.4% for the last 12 months. But what is critical, if you look at just the expansions, don't include the recessions since 1968, the average growth in employment in an expansion year was 1.9%. And in the last 12 months, we're a half a percentage point under that. Yet there is a perception that the employment gains are strong. And this of course, undermines the improvement of the standard of living. Perception is that the job gains are strong when in fact they are not. And there is, because of the liquidity and the need of some investors to fully participate in the rising stock market, they tend to overlook other important developments. If we go back to the 12 months ending November of 2015, real average hourly earnings were up about 2.5% for the 12 months ending. And in the latest 12 months, it looks like real average hourly earnings are actually negative for the last 12 months. So there is the liquidity tends to push the focus away from the more realistic interpretation of the economy for certain types of assets. However, the weak performance overall and the deceleration in some of the indicators that I just referred to is not being unnoticed by the bond market. So we have this dichotomy where the stock market is up strongly, but the long-term bond yields are down. Now, the short-term yields are up because they are under the control or heavy influence of the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is in the process of raising the short-term rates, and they are also unwinding their portfolio. They liquidated $20 billion of government and agency securities in October and November. And so the Fed is pushing up the short-term rates, but the long-term rates, looking at some of these more important fundamentals, are actually declining. And another element that is not in the public view at all, because the Federal Reserve no longer does monetary analysis, is that we are seeing a very sharp slowdown in the rate of growth in money supply and in bank loans, and important credit aggregates. The last year, the M2 money supply was up 7%. It's decelerated to less than 4.5% in the latest 12 months. And the rate of growth in bank loans and commercial paper, which topped out on a 12-month basis at about 9%, is now under 4%. So the Fed's raising of the short-term rates and reducing the monetary base are causing a tightening in the financial side of the economy. And enough investors see that. It's not in the general psyche because monetary analysis is no longer very common. The yield curve is flattening very dramatically. And when the yield curve flattens in the way that it is today, it's first of all a symptom that monetary restraint is beginning to bite. Now, the slowdown in money supply growth, bank credit, flattening of the yield curve, these occur well before there is any noticeable impact on a broad array of economic indicators. There are long lags in monetary policy. But when the yield curve starts flattening, that intensifies the effect of the monetary tightening because it takes away and greatly reduces the profitability of the banks and all those that act like banks. The banks make a profit by borrowing short, lending long. When those spreads come down, bank profitability is hurt, particularly for the higher riskier types of bank loans. Not enough spread there to cover the risk premium. So the banks begin to pull back, and this further intensifies the restraint. that's emanating on the economy. So we have an economy the vast majority of people, vast majority of investors think is doing very well. But in fact, there are elements right beneath the surface that suggest very strongly, to me at least, that the outlook for 2018 is considerably more guarded than the conventional wisdom.
Mm-hmm. And do you see the potential for an inverted yield curve in the near future?
I'm not sure that we will have to invert because the economy is so heavily indebted and the velocity of money is lower than any time since 1949. Now, a number of people have pointed out that we typically invert before a recession, and that historically has been the case most of the time, not all of the time, if you go back far enough. But see, this is not a normal economy. For example, money supply growth since 1900 has averaged about 7% per annum, whereas currently the rate of growth in M2 is about 36% below the long-term average. This is a very weak rate of growth in money. And the velocity of money is lower than all of the years since 1942, with the exception of 7 years. And the economy has never been this heavily indebted. And so I'm thinking that what we might see is that the yield curve could possibly approach inversion, but it may or may not go through it, but it won't stay there very long, because at that stage of the game, the flattening of the yield curve will greatly intensify all of these other effects. The reduction in the reserve aggregates, the monetary aggregates, the credit aggregates, and the weakness in velocity. And when this becomes apparent, the Federal Reserve will not be able to reverse gears quickly enough to ameliorate the impact that this will produce in terms of future economic growth.
Mm-hmm. So do you still see a secular low in bond yields? On the long end of the yield curve remaining in the future sometime?
Yeah, I think the long end lows have not been seen. Wow. It will remain extremely volatile, as we have been, and we will have episodes in which the long yields rise. My attitude is that the long yields can go up over the short run for any one of a number of causes. There are so many elements at work out in the long end, but that they cannot stay up, because when the yields go up, and especially now that the yield curve is flattening, this intensifies monetary restraint, which puts downward pressure on commodities. We're beginning to see some of that. It puts upward pressure on the value of the dollar, and it cuts back on the lending operations. And One of the things that I think has been sort of overlooked in the general euphoria over the strength of stock prices, another one, is the fact that commercial and industrial loans for all the banks in the United States are now only up 0.1% in the last 12 months. There are forward-looking elements that have been very important historically that are signaling that change is ahead. They don't tell us the timing. Timing is always difficult. But they are flashing signals that should be observed.
Mm-hmm. And as this plays out, do you see monetary policy and fiscal policy as changing? Like, will we get fiscal policy stimulus? Will there be a change in monetary policy, and how will that look like?
Well, with regard to the here is my attitude. The funding, new federal initiatives, whether they're tax cuts or infrastructure or what have you, will not provide a boost to the economy if it is funded with increases in debt. That's where we're at. Mm-hmm. If you and by the way, it's been that way for some time. If you go back to 2009, we had a $1 trillion stimulus package that was said to be inflationary and was going to boost economic growth. But yet we still had this very poor expansion and inflation, except for intermittent bouts here and there, largely in highly price inelastic goods, the inflation rate has trended lower. And so the basic, when President Reagan cut taxes, government debt was 31% of GDP. And now it's 106, on its way to 120, 25. And so the if you go back and if you read David Ricardo's great article in 1821, he was asked whether it made any difference as to whether the Napoleonic Wars were financed by taxes or by borrowing. And Ricardo said that theoretically, they're the same. Either way, you're going to suppress private sector activity. And now we have a lot of evidence, including some that I've produced, that the government multiplier is negative, not positive, over a three-year period. May work for a very short while, but not on balance. And you see, in these, if the tax cuts were revenue neutral, and they were financed by reductions in government expenditures, that would be positive.
I see.
Because what the evidence shows that the tax multipliers are more favorable than the expenditure multipliers. There's greater efficiency in private sector spending than government spending. And so you would also, there's also evidence that you would lower the cost of capital. But that's not what we're talking about, is it? Where we're talking about a debt finance tax cut. And we're not talking about a revenue neutral infrastructure plan, just as we were not talking about revenue neutral in 2009. We're talking about a debt financed. And at this stage of the game, those options will not work for us. They're going to make us more vulnerable, except for a few fleeting instances. I will say this, when you have a debt-financed infrastructure program or tax cut, there will be pockets within the economy that will benefit. But the aggregate economic performance will not benefit. And so fiscal policy, as I see it, is not really going to be helpful. And the risk is that the debt buildup will add to the problems. There's very serious academic research that shows that when government debt rises above 90% of GDP for more than 5 years, you lose a third of the economy's growth rate from trend. Well, actually, we're now at 106, and there's some evidence at these higher levels of debt, the effect is nonlinear. In other words, we lose growth at a faster pace.
Wow. Yeah.
And there's a lot of evidence, if you just look at the data, that we're losing a half of our growth rate from trend. GDP rose at 2.1% per capita since 1790. The latest 10 years, we're at 1.0. And so we should have lost only 7/10. We should have come down to 1.3, but we're at 1. And it looks like that is a consequence that we have to deal with. We're not in a position to ignore the debt levels. So fiscal policy can be talked about. We can debate about it. We can proclaim its benefits, but I don't see them in the current environment. Just as I didn't see them in 2009. I would change my tune if they were revenue neutral, believe you me. But that's not the issue here. And as regard to monetary policy, I think monetary policy is really off center. To me, Inflation is a money price wage spiral, not a wage price spiral. That's the Phillips curve. The way inflation gets started is you have an acceleration in money supply growth that's not offset by weakness in velocity. And that shifts the aggregate demand curve inward. Remember, the aggregate demand curve is equal to money times velocity by algebraic substitution. That's true in all the leading textbooks, macroeconomics. So you have money supply declining, velocity declining, so the aggregate demand curve over time is going to shift inward, which gives you a lower price level, and lower level of real GDP. Doesn't happen every quarter or even every year, but that's the basic trend. And so monetary policy is in the process not of accelerating money supply growth, but they are decelerating money supply growth very significantly. And if the Fed adheres to their schedule of quantitative tightening, I calculate that M2 growth by the end of the first quarter, it's currently running around 4.5%. The year-over-year growth rate will be down to less than 3%. And so monetary policy is taking steps to lower the reserve monetary and credit aggregates. And these actions, by the way, will further flatten the curve because they can press the short rates up. But the long-term investors, I think, will understand that the inflationary prospects on a fundamental basis are getting weaker, not stronger.
And do you see these trends as being exacerbated on the emerging government pension fund crisis? Like, could there be more debt used to solve that, like for bailouts? Do you see that potentially happening?
Well, the main problem with government debt is that we're going to have approximately 1 million folks a year reach age 70 for the next 14 or 15 years. And we've made a lot of promises under Social Security, Medicare, and the Affordable Care Act. And we've known that this was coming, but we didn't prepare for it. And so government debt will have to be used to fund the entitlement benefits. And I don't see any other way around it. And another problem that I think is being overlooked is that the actual federal fiscal situation is much worse than the numbers appear on the surface. Now, for example, in the last 3 years, the budget deficit has gotten worse each year. But if you sum the budget deficits for 2015, 16, and 17, the sum is $1.2 trillion. But a lot of what were previously called outlays have been moved off budget. We call them investments or something else. Student loans is a big category there, the others. The actual increase in federal debt in the last 3 years is $3.2 trillion. So the budget deficit is actually greatly understating what is happening to the level of federal debt. Mm-hmm. That didn't always used to be the case. And by the way, that was worsened by a bipartisan deal between one party that controlled Congress and another party that controlled the White House in 2015. Mm-hmm. Ever. Neither party is blameless. They both agreed on it. But it didn't change the fact that the federal situation is deteriorating and much worse than the deficit numbers themselves indicate.
And what about, like, for state and local jurisdiction locales in terms of their government pension funds? Could there be federal-level bailouts at that level?
Again, what are they going to bail them out with? Hmm. You're going to have to sell federal securities. Mm-hmm. And what are the multipliers on new sales of federal debt? They're negative. not positive. Forget what was taught to you in your macroeconomic class 20 years ago, or 30 years ago, even 15 years ago.
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
When I was in graduate school, I was taught that the government multiplier was somewhere between 4 and 5. But that's not the case. It looks like it's at best 0 and possibly slightly negative.
Yes. No worries. But great insight. As always, how can our listeners learn more about your work, Dr. Hunt?
Well, we put out a quarterly letter, which they can write to us at HoisingtonMGT.com. And you send us your contact information, and we'll provide you our quarterly letter as a public service. Please do that. No one will contact you. We don't market the letter. We just make it available to anyone that has an interest.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for being on the program show, Dr. Hunt. Thank you.
My pleasure, Richard. Nice to be with you.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.